schooling, extending into tertiary and postgraduate education in colleges and universities, continues to grow in every country. In 1920, just 28% of American teenagers between 14 and 17 were in high school. By 1930, the proportion had grown to almost half. And by 2011, 80% graduated, of whom almost 70% went on to college. In 1940, less than 5% of Americans held a bachelor's degree. By 2015, almost a third did. Figure 16-3 shows the parallel trajectories of the length of schooling in a sample of countries, with recent highs ranging from 4 years in Sierra Leone to 13 years, some college, in the United States. According to one projection, by the end of the century, more than 90% of the world's population will have some secondary education, and 40% some college. Since educated people tend to have fewer children, the growth of education is a major reason that, later in this century, world population is expected to peak and then decline. Figure 10-1. Though we see little or no global convergence in the length of formal schooling, an ongoing revolution in the dissemination of knowledge makes the gap less relevant. Most of the world's knowledge is now online, rather than locked in libraries, much of it free, and massive open online courses, MOOCs, and other forms of distance learning are becoming available to anyone with a smartphone. Other disparities in education are shrinking as well. In the United States, measures of school readiness among low-income Hispanic and African-American children increased substantially between 1998 and 2010, possibly because free preschool programs are more widely available, and because poor families today have more books, computers, and internet access, and the parents spend more time interacting with their children. Even more consequentially, the ultimate form of sex discrimination, keeping girls out of school, is in decline. The change is consequential, not just because women make up half the population, so educating them doubles the size of the skill pool, but because the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. When girls are educated, they are healthier, have fewer and healthier children, and are more productive, and so are their countries. It took the West centuries to figure out that educating the whole population, not just the half with testicles, was a good idea. The line for England in Figure 16-4 shows that English women did not become as literate as English men until 1885. The world as a whole caught on even later, but quickly made up for lost time, going from teaching only two-thirds as many girls as boys to read in 1975 to teaching them in equal numbers in 2014. The United Nations has announced that the world has met the 2015 Millennium Development Goal of achieving gender parity in primary, secondary, and tertiary education. The other two lines tell their own story. The country with the worst gender ratio for literacy is Afghanistan. Not only is Afghanistan near the bottom in almost every measure of human development, including its overall literacy rate, which in 2011 stood at an abysmal 0.52, but from 1996 to 2001, it was under the control of the Taliban, the Islamic fundamentalist movement, that, among other atrocities, forbade girls and women from attending school. The Taliban has continued to intimidate girls from getting an education in the regions of Afghanistan and neighboring Pakistan it controls. Starting in 2009, the 12-year-old Malala Yousafzai, whose family ran a chain of schools in the Swat district of Pakistan, publicly spoke out for girls' right to an education. On a day that will live in infamy, October 9, 2012, a Taliban gunman boarded her school bus and shot her in the head. She survived to become the youngest winner of the Nobel Peace Prize and one of the world's most admired women. Yet even in these benighted parts of the world, progress can be seen. In the past 3 decades, the literacy gender ratio has doubled in Afghanistan and increased by half in Pakistan, whose ratio now matches that for the world in 1980 and for England in 1850. Nothing is certain, but the global tide of activism, economic development, common sense, and common decency are likely to push the ratio to its natural ceiling. Could the world be getting not just more literate and knowledgeable, but actually smarter? Might people be increasingly adept at learning new skills, grasping abstract ideas, and solving unforeseen problems? Amazingly, the answer is yes. Intelligence quotient, IQ scores, have been rising for more than a century in every part of the world at a rate of about 3 IQ points, a fifth of a standard deviation per decade. When the philosopher James Flynn first brought this phenomenon to psychologists' attention in 1984, many thought it must have been a mistake or trick. For one thing, we know that intelligence is highly heritable, and the world has not engaged in a massive eugenics project in which smarter people have had more babies generation after generation. Nor have people been marrying outside their clan and tribe, thus avoiding inbreeding and increasing hybrid vigor in great enough numbers for a long enough time to explain the rise. Also, it beggars belief to think that an average person of 1910, if he or she had entered a time machine and materialized today, would be borderline retarded by our standards, while if Joe and Jane Average made the reverse journey, they would outsmart 98% of the befrocked and bewhiskered Edwardians who greeted them as they emerged. Yet surprising as it is, the Flynn effect is no longer in doubt, and it has recently been confirmed in a meta-analysis of 271 samples from 31 countries with 4 million people. Figure 16-5 plots the secular rise in IQ scores, as psychologists call it, secular in the sense of long-term rather than irreligious. Note that each line plots the change in IQ scores in a continent relative to the average score in the earliest year for which data are available, which is arbitrarily set to zero because the tests and periods for the different continents are not directly commensurable. We cannot read the graph as we did the previous ones and infer, for example, that the IQ of Africa in 2007 is equivalent to the IQ of Australia and New Zealand in 1970. Not surprisingly, the rise in IQ scores obeys Stein's law. Things that can't go on forever, don't. The Flynn effect is now petering out in some of the countries in which it has been going on the longest. Though it's not easy to pinpoint the causes of the rise in IQ scores, it's no paradox that a heritable trait can be boosted by changes in the environment. That's what happened with height, a trait that also is highly heritable and has increased over the decades, and for some of the same reasons, better nutrition and less disease. Brains are greedy organs, consuming about a fifth of the body's energy, and they are made of fats and proteins that are demanding for the body to produce. Fighting off infections is metabolically expensive, and the immune system of a sick child may commandeer resources that would otherwise go to brain development. Also helping with brain development is a cleaner environment, with lower levels of lead and other toxins. Food, health, and environmental quality are among the perquisites of a richer society, and not surprisingly, the Flynn effect is correlated with increases in GDP per capita. But nutrition and health can explain only a part of the Flynn effect. For one thing, their benefits should be concentrated in pulling up the lower half of the bell curve of IQ scores, populated by the duller people who had been held back by poor food and health. After all, past a certain point, additional food makes people fatter, not smarter. Indeed, in some times and places, the Flynn effect is concentrated in the lower half, bringing the duller closer to the average. But in other times and places, the entire curve crept rightward. The smart got smarter, too, even though they started out healthy and well-fed. Second, improvements in health and nutrition should affect children most of all, and then the adults they grow into. But the Flynn effect is stronger for adults than for children, suggesting that experiences on the way to adulthood, not just biological constitution in early childhood, have pushed IQ scores higher. The most obvious of these experiences is education. Also, while IQ has risen over the decades, and nutrition, health, and height have risen over the decades, their various ascents and plateaus don't track each other particularly closely. But the main reason that health and nutrition aren't enough to explain the IQ rise is that what has risen over time is not overall brain power. The Flynn effect is not an increase in G, the general intelligence factor that underlies every subtype of intelligence, verbal, spatial, mathematical, memory, and so on, and is the aspect of intelligence most directly affected by the genes. While overall IQ has risen, and scores on each intelligence subtest have risen, some subtest scores have risen more rapidly than others in a pattern different from the pattern linked to the genes. That's another reason the Flynn effect does not cast doubt on the high heritability of IQ. So, which kinds of intellectual performance have been pushed upward by the better environments of recent decades?
Surprisingly, the steepest gains have not been found in the concrete skills that are directly taught in school,
such as general knowledge, arithmetic, and vocabulary. They have been found in the abstract, fluid kinds of intelligence, the ones tapped by similarity questions. What do an hour and a year have in common? Analogies. Bird is to egg as tree is to what? And visual matrices, where the test taker has to choose a complex geometric figure that fits into a rule-governed sequence. What has increased the most, then, is an analytic mindset, putting concepts into abstract categories. An hour and a year are units of time, mentally dissecting objects into their parts and relationships rather than absorbing them as wholes, and placing oneself in a hypothetical world defined by certain rules and exploring its logical implications while setting aside everyday experience. Suppose that in country X everything is made of plastic. Are the ovens made of plastic? An analytic mindset is inculcated by formal schooling, even if a teacher never singles it out in a lesson, as long as the curriculum requires understanding and reasoning rather than rote memorization. And that has been the trend in education since the early decades of the 20th century. Outside the schoolhouse, analytic thinking is encouraged by a culture that trades in visual symbols, subway maps, digital displays, analytic tools, spreadsheets, stock reports, and academic concepts that trickle down into common parlance. Supply and demand, on average, human rights, win-win, correlation versus causation, false positive. Does the Flynn effect matter in the real world? Almost certainly. A high IQ is not just a number that you can brag about in a bar or that gets you into Mensa. It is a tailwind in life. People with high scores on intelligence tests get better jobs, perform better in their jobs, enjoy better health and longer lives, are less likely to get into trouble with the law, and have a greater number of noteworthy accomplishments like starting companies, earning patents, and creating respected works of art, all holding socioeconomic status constant. The myth, still popular among leftist intellectuals, that IQ doesn't exist or cannot be reliably measured was refuted decades ago. We don't know whether these bonuses come from G alone, or also from the Flynn component of intelligence. But the answer is probably both. Flynn has speculated, and I agree, that abstract reasoning can even hone the moral sense. The cognitive act of extricating oneself from the particulars of one's life and pondering, "There but for fortune go I," or "What would the world be like if everyone did this?" can be a gateway to compassion and ethics. Since intelligence brings good things, and intelligence has been increasing, can we see a dividend from increasing intelligence in improvements to the world? Some skeptics, including at the outset Flynn himself, doubted whether the 20th century really produced more brilliant ideas than the ages of Hume, Goethe, and Darwin. Then again, the geniuses of the past had the advantage of exploring virgin territory. Once someone discovers the analytic synthetic distinction or the theory of natural selection, no one can ever discover it again. Today, the intellectual landscape is well trodden, and it's harder for a solitary genius to tower above the crowd of hyper-educated and networked thinkers who are mapping every nook and cranny. Still, there have been some signs of a smarter populace, such as the fact that the world's top-ranked chess and bridge players have been getting younger. And no one can second-guess the warp speed of advances in science and technology of the past half-century. Most dramatically, an increase in one kind of abstract intelligence is visible all over the world. Mastery of digital technology. Cyberspace is the ultimate abstract realm, in which goals are achieved not by pushing matter around in space, but by manipulating intangible symbols and patterns. When people were first confronted with digital interfaces in the 1970s, like video cassette recorders and ticket machines in new subway systems, they were baffled. It was a running joke of the 1980s that most VCRs eternally flashed 12 o'clock at owners who couldn't figure out how to set the time. But Generation X and the millennials have famously thrived in the digital realm. In one cartoon of the new millennium, a father says to his young boy, "Son, your mother and I have bought software to control what you see on the internet. Could you install it for us?" The developing world has thrived in that realm as well, often leapfrogging the West in its adoption of smartphones and of applications for them, such as mobile banking, education, and real-time market updates. Could the Flynn effect help explain the other rises in well-being we have seen in these chapters? An analysis by the economist R.W. Hafer suggests it could. Holding all the usual confounding variables constant, education, GDP, government spending, even a country's religious makeup and its history of colonization, he found that a country's average IQ predicted its subsequent growth in GDP per capita, together with growth in non-economic measures of well-being like longevity and leisure time. An 11-point increase in IQ, he estimated, would accelerate a country's growth rate enough to double well-being in just 19 years rather than 27. Policies that hurry the Flynn effect along, namely investments in health, nutrition, and education, could make a country richer, better governed, and happier down the road. What's good for humanity is not always good for social science, and it may be impossible to unsnarl the bundle of correlations among all the ways that life is improved and trace the causal arrows with certainty. But let's stop fretting for a moment about how hard it is to disentangle the strands and instead take note of their common direction. The very fact that so many dimensions of well-being are correlated across countries and decades suggests there may be a coherent phenomenon lurking beneath them, what statisticians call a general factor, a principal component, or a hidden, latent, or intervening variable. We even have a name for that factor: progress. No one has calculated this vector of progress underlying all the dimensions of human flourishing, but the United Nations Development Program, inspired by the economists Mahbub ul Haq and Amartya Sen, offers a human development index that is a composite of three of the major ones: life expectancy, GDP per capita, and education, being healthy, wealthy, and wise. With this chapter, we have now examined all of these goods, and it's an appropriate point to step back and take in the history of quantifiable human progress before we turn to its more qualitative aspects in the next two chapters. Two economists have developed their own versions of a human development index that can be estimated retroactively into the 19th century, each of which aggregates measures of longevity, income, and education in different ways. Leandro Prados de la Escosura's Historical Index of Human Development, which goes back to 1870, averages the three measures with a geometric rather than an arithmetic mean, so that an extreme value on one measure cannot swamp the other two, and transforms the longevity and education measures to compensate for diminishing returns at their high end. Auke Reitma of the How Was Life Project, whose data have appeared in a number of graphs in this book, developed a well-being composite that goes back to 1820. Together with the Big Three, it throws in measures of height, a proxy for health, democracy, homicide, income inequality, and biodiversity. The latter two are the only ones that don't systematically improve over the past two centuries. The grades for the world on these two report cards are shown in Figure 16-6. To behold this graph is to apprehend human progress at a glance, and packed into the lines are two vital subplots. One is that although the world remains highly unequal, every region has been improving, and the worst-off parts of the world today are better off than the best-off parts not long ago. If we divide the world into the West and the rest, we find that the rest in 2007 had reached the level of the West in 1950. The other is that while almost every indicator of human well-being correlates with wealth, the lines don't just reflect a wealthier world. Longevity, health, and knowledge have increased even in many of the times and places where wealth has not. The fact that all aspects of human flourishing tend to improve over the long run, even when they are not in perfect sync, vindicates the idea that there is such a thing as progress. Chapter 17. Quality of Life. Though only the callous would deny that the conquests of disease, hunger, and illiteracy are stupendous achievements, one can still wonder whether continuous improvements in the kinds of things that economists measure should count as genuine progress. Once basic needs are satisfied, doesn't additional affluence just encourage people to indulge in shallow consumerism? And weren't increases in health and literacy trumpeted by the five-year planners in the Soviet Union, China, and Cuba, all of which were rather grim places to live? People can be healthy, solvent, and literate, and still not lead rich and meaningful lives. Some of these reservations have already been answered. We've seen that totalitarianism, the main impediment to the good life in communist so-called utopias, has been receding. We've also seen that a major dimension of flourishing that is not captured by the standard metrics, the rights of women, children, and minorities, is on a steady rise. This chapter is about a broader cultural pessimism, the worry that all that extra healthy lifespan and income may not have increased human flourishing after all, if they just consign people to a rat race of frenzied careerism, hollow consumption, mindless entertainment, and soul-deadening anemia. To be sure, one can object to the objection, which comes from a long tradition of cultural and religious elites sneering at the supposedly empty lives of the bourgeoisie and proletariat. Cultural criticism can be a thinly disguised snobbery that shades into misanthropy. In The Intellectuals and the Masses, the critic John Carey shows how the British literary intelligentsia in the first decades of the 20th century harbored a contempt for the common person which bordered on the genocidal. In practice, consumerism often means consumption by the other guy, since the elites who condemn it tend themselves to be conspicuous consumers of exorbitant luxuries like hardcover books, good food and wine, live artistic performances, overseas travel, and Ivy-class education for their children. If more people can afford their preferred luxuries, even if they are frivolous by the lights of their cultural betters, that has to be counted as a good thing. In an old joke, a soapbox orator addresses a crowd on the glories of communism. Come the revolution, everyone will eat strawberries and cream. A man at the front whimpers, but I don't like strawberries and cream. The speaker thunders, come the revolution, you will like strawberries and cream. In Development as Freedom, Amartya Sen sidesteps this trap by proposing that the ultimate goal of development is to enable people to make choices, strawberries and cream for those who want them. The philosopher Martha Nussbaum has taken the idea a step further and laid out a set of fundamental capabilities that all people should be given the opportunity to exercise. One can think of them as the justifiable sources of satisfaction and fulfillment that human nature makes available to us. Her list begins with capabilities that, as we have seen, the modern world increasingly allows people to realize. Longevity, health, safety, literacy, knowledge, free expression, and political participation. It goes on to include aesthetic experience, recreation and play, enjoyment of nature, emotional attachments, social affiliations, and opportunities to reflect on and engage in one's own conception of the good life. In this chapter, I'll show how modernity is increasingly allowing people to exercise these capabilities too,
that life is getting better even beyond the standard economists' metrics like longevity and wealth. Admittedly, many people still don't like strawberries and cream, and they may exercise one capability, enjoying their freedom to watch television and play video games, to forego others, such as aesthetic appreciation and enjoyment of nature. When Dorothy Parker was challenged to use the word horticulture in a sentence, she answered, "You can lead a horticulture, but you can't make her think." But an expansive cafeteria of opportunities to enjoy the aesthetic, intellectual, social, cultural, and natural delights of the world, regardless of which ones people put on their trays, is the ultimate form of progress. Time is what life is made of, and one metric of progress is a reduction in the time people must devote to keeping themselves alive at the expense of the other, more enjoyable things in life. "In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread," said the ever-merciful God as he exiled Adam and Eve from Eden. And for most people throughout history, sweat they did. Farming is a sun-up-to-sundown occupation, and though foragers hunt and gather just a few hours a day, they spend many more hours processing the food. For example, smashing rock-hard nuts, in addition to gathering firewood, carrying water, and laboring at other chores. The San of the Kalahari, once called the original affluent society, turn out to work at least 8 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week, on food alone. The 60-hour work week of Bob Cratchit, with only one day off a year, Christmas, of course, was in fact lenient by the standards of his era. Figure 17-1 shows that in 1870, Western Europeans worked an average of 66 hours a week. The Belgians worked 72, while Americans worked 62 hours. Over the past century and a half, workers have increasingly been emancipated from their wage slavery, more dramatically in social democratic Western Europe, where they now work 28 fewer hours a week than in the go-getter United States, where they work 22 fewer hours. As late as the 1950s, my paternal grandfather worked behind the cheese counter in an unheated Montreal market, day and night, 7 days a week, afraid to ask for shorter hours lest he be replaced. When my young parents protested on his behalf, he was given sporadic days off, which the owner no doubt perceived, like Scrooge, as a poor excuse for picking a man's pocket, until better labor law enforcement gave him a predictable 6-day work week. Though a lucky few of us are paid to exercise our fundamental capabilities and willingly put in Victorian hours, most workers are grateful for the 24 extra hours a week they have available to fulfill themselves in other ways. On his hard-won day off, my grandfather would read the Yiddish papers, dress up in a jacket, tie, and fedora, and visit his sisters or my family. Likewise, though many of my fellow professors end their careers carried out of their offices feet first, workers in many other jobs are happy to spend their golden years reading, taking courses, seeing the national parks in a Winnebago, or dandling Vera, Chuck, and Dave in a cottage on the Isle of Wight. This, too, is a gift of modernity. As Morgan Housel notes, we constantly worry about the looming retirement funding crisis in America, without realizing that the entire concept of retirement is unique to the last 5 decades. It wasn't long ago that the average American man had 2 stages of life, work and death. Think of it this way. The average American now retires at age 62. 100 years ago, the average American died at age 51. Figure 17-2 shows that in 1880, almost 80% of American men of what we now consider retirement age were still in the workforce, and that by 1990, the proportion had fallen to less than 20%. Rather than looking forward to retirement, people used to dread the injury or frailty that would keep them from work and send them to the almshouse, the haunting fear in the winter of life, as it was known. Even after the Social Security Act of 1935 protected the elderly from utter destitution, poverty was a common end to a working life, and I grew up with the image, possibly an urban legend, of pensioners who subsisted on dog food. But with stronger public and private safety nets in place, senior citizens today are richer than people of working age. The poverty rate for people over 65, plunged from 35% in 1960 to less than 10% in 2011, well below the national rate of 15%. Thanks to the labor movement, legislation, and increased worker productivity, another once crazy pipe dream has become a reality. Paid vacations. Today, an average American worker with 5 years on the job receives 22 days of paid time off a year, compared with 16 days in 1970, and that is miserly by the standards of Western Europe. The combination of a shorter work week, more paid time off, and a longer retirement means that the fraction of a person's life that is taken up by work has fallen by a quarter, just since 1960. Trends for the developing world vary by country, but as these countries get richer, they are likely to follow those of the West. There is yet another way in which thick tranches of life have been freed up for people to pursue higher callings. In Chapter 9, we saw that appliances such as refrigerators, vacuum cleaners, washing machines, and microwave ovens have become common or universal, even among the American poor. In 1919, an average American wage earner had to work 1,800 hours to pay for a refrigerator. In 2014, he or she had to work fewer than 24 hours, and the new fridge was frost-free and came with an ice maker. Mindless consumerism? Not when you remember that food, clothing, and shelter are the three necessities of life, that entropy degrades all three, and that the time it takes to keep them usable is time that could be devoted to other pursuits. Electricity, running water, and appliances, or as they used to be called, labor-saving devices, give us that time back. The many hours our grandmothers spent pumping, canning, churning, pickling, curing, sweeping, waxing, scrubbing, wringing, sudsing, drying, stitching, mending, knitting, darning, and, as they used to remind us, slaving over a hot stove, working our fingers to the bone. Figure 17-3 shows that as utilities and appliances penetrated American households during the 20th century, the amount of life that people lost to housework, which not surprisingly people say is their least favorite way to spend their time, fell almost fourfold, from 58 hours a week in 1900 to 15.5 hours in 2011. Time spent on laundry alone fell from 11.5 hours a week in 1920 to 1.5 in 2014. For returning wash day to our lives, Hans Rosling suggests, the washing machine deserves to be called the greatest invention of the Industrial Revolution. As a feminist-era husband, I can truthfully use the first-person plural in celebrating this gain. But in most times and places, housework is gendered, so the liberation of humankind from household labor is in practice the liberation of women from household labor. Perhaps the liberation of women in general. Arguments for the equality of women go back to Mary Astle's 1700 treatise and are irrefutable. So why did they take centuries to catch on? In a 1912 interview in Good Housekeeping magazine, Thomas Edison prophesied one of the great social transformations of the 20th century. The housewife of the future will be neither a slave to servants nor herself a drudge. She will give less attention to the home because the home will need less. She will be rather a domestic engineer than a domestic laborer, with the greatest of all handmaidens, electricity, at her service. This and other mechanical forces will so revolutionize the woman's world that a large portion of the aggregate of woman's energy will be conserved for use in broader, more constructive fields. Time is not the only life-enriching resource granted to us by technology. Another is light. Light is so empowering that it serves as the metaphor of choice for a superior intellectual and spiritual state. Enlightenment. In the natural world, we are plunged into darkness for half of our existence, but human-made light allows us to take back the night for reading, moving about, seeing people's faces, and otherwise engaging with our surroundings. The economist William Nordhaus has cited the plunging price, and hence the soaring availability, of this universally treasured resource as an emblem of progress. Figure 17-4 shows that the inflation-adjusted price of a million lumen-hours of light,
about what you would need to read for 2.5 hours a day for a year, has fallen 12,000-fold since the Middle Ages, once called the Dark Ages, from around £35,500 in 1300 to less than £3 today. These days and nights, if you aren't reading, conversing, getting out, or otherwise edifying yourself, it's not because you can't afford the light. The plunging cash value of artificial light actually understates the progress, because as Adam Smith pointed out, the real price of everything is the toil and trouble of acquiring it. Nordhaus estimated how many hours a person would have to work to earn an hour of light to read by at different times in history. A Babylonian in 1750 BCE would have had to labor 50 hours to spend 1 hour reading his cuneiform tablets by a sesame oil lamp. In 1800, an Englishman had to toil for 6 hours to burn a tallow candle for an hour. Imagine planning your family budget around that. You might settle for darkness. In 1880, you'd need to work 15 minutes to burn a kerosene lamp for an hour. In 1950, 8 seconds for the same hour from an incandescent bulb. And in 1994, a half second for the same hour from a compact fluorescent bulb. A 43,000-fold leap in affordability in 2 centuries. And the progress wasn't finished. Nordhaus published his article before LED bulbs flooded the market. Soon, cheap, solar-powered LED lamps will transform the lives of the more than 1 billion people without access to electricity, allowing them to read the news or do their homework without huddling around an oil drum filled with burning garbage. The declining proportion of our lives we have to forfeit for light, appliances, and food may be part of a general law. The technology expert Kevin Kelly has proposed that, over time, if a technology persists long enough, its costs begin to approach, but never reach, zero. As the necessities of life get cheaper, we waste fewer of our waking hours obtaining them, and have more time and money left over for everything else, and the everything else gets cheaper too, so we can experience more of them. Figure 17-5 shows that in 1929, Americans spent more than 60% of their disposable income on necessities. By 2016, that had fallen to a third. What are people doing with that extra time and money? Are they truly enriching their lives, or are they just buying more golf clubs and designer handbags? Though it's presumptuous to pass judgment on how people choose to spend their days, we can focus on the pursuits that almost everyone would agree are constituents of a good life: connecting with loved ones and friends, experiencing the richness of the natural and cultural worlds, and having access to the fruits of intellectual and artistic creativity. With the rise of 2-career couples, overscheduled kids, and digital devices, there is a widespread belief and recurring media panic that families are caught in a time crunch that's killing the family dinner. Both Al Gore and Dan Quayle lamented its demise in the run-up to the 2000 presidential election, and that was before smartphones and social media. But the new tugs and distractions have to be weighed against the 24 extra hours that modernity has granted to breadwinners every week, and the 42 extra hours it has granted to homemakers. Though people increasingly complain about how crazy busy they are, yuppie kvetching, as one team of economists put it, a different picture emerges when they are asked to keep track of their time. In 2015, men reported 42 hours of leisure per week, around 10 more than their counterparts did 50 years earlier, and women reported 36 hours, more than 6 hours more. Figure 17-6. To be fair, the yuppies might have something to kvetch about. Less educated people reported having more leisure, and this inequality in reverse has grown over these 50 years. Similar trends have been reported in Western Europe. Nor are Americans consistently feeling more harried. A review by the sociologist John Robinson shows some ups and downs between 1965 and 2010 in the percentage you say they feel always rushed, with a low of 18% in 1976 and a high of 35% in 1998, but no consistent trend over 45 years. And at the end of the day, the family dinner is alive and well.
Several studies and polls agree that the number of dinners families have together changed little from 1960 through 2014, despite the iPhones, PlayStations, and Facebook accounts. Indeed, over the course of the 20th century, typical American parents spent more time, not less, with their children. In 1924, only 45% of mothers spent 2 or more hours a day with their children. 7% spent no time with them, and only 60% of fathers spent at least an hour a day with them. By 1999, the proportions had risen to 71 and 83%. In fact, single and working mothers today spend more time with their children than stay-at-home married mothers did in 1965. An increase in hours spent caring for children is the main reason for the dip in leisure time, visible in Figure 17-6. But time use studies are no match for Norman Rockwell and Leave It to Beaver, and many people misremember the mid-20th century as a golden age of family togetherness. Electronic media are commonly cited as a threat to human relationships, and certainly Facebook friends are a poor substitute for face-to-face contact with flesh and blood companions. Yet overall, electronic technology has been a priceless gift to human closeness. A century ago, if family members moved to a distant city, one might never hear their voices or see their faces again. Grandchildren grew up without their grandparents laying eyes on them. Couples separated by study, work, or war would reread a letter dozens of times and tumble into despair if the next one was late, not knowing whether the postal service had lost it or whether the lover was angry, faithless, or dead. An agony recounted in songs like the Marvelettes and Beatles' Please, Mr. Postman, and Simon and Garfunkel's Why Don't You Write Me? Even when long-distance telephony allowed people to reach out and touch someone, the exorbitant cost put a strain on intimacy. People of my generation remember the awkwardness of speed-talking on a payphone while feeding at quarters between bongs, or the breakneck sprint when called to the family phone, "It's long distance!" or the sinking feeling of the rent money evaporating as a pleasant conversation unfolded. Only connect, advised E.M. Forster. And electronic technology is allowing us to connect as never before. Today, almost half of the world's population has internet access, and three-quarters have access to a mobile phone. The marginal cost of a long-distance conversation is essentially zero, and the conversants can now see as well as hear each other. And speaking of seeing, the plunging cost of photography is another gift to the richness of experience. In past eras, people had only a mental image to remind them of a family member, living or dead. Today, like billions of others, I get a wave of gratitude for my blessings several times a day as my eyes alight on a photo of my loved ones. Affordable photography also allows the high points of life to be lived many times, not just once. The precious occasions, the stunning sights, the long-gone cityscapes, the elderly in their prime, the grown-ups as children, the children as babies. Even in the future, when we have 3D holographic surround sound virtual reality with haptic exoskeleton gloves, we will still want to be within touching distance of the people we love. So the shrinking cost of transportation is another boon to humanity. Trains, buses, and cars have multiplied the opportunities for us to get together, and the remarkable democratization of plane travel has removed the barriers of distance and oceans. The term jet set for chic celebrities is an anachronism from the 1960s, when no more than a fifth of Americans had ever flown in a plane. Despite soaring fuel costs, the real price of plane travel in the United States has fallen by more than half since the late 1970s, when the airlines were deregulated, Figure 17-7. In 1974, it cost $1,442, in 2011 dollars, to fly from New York to Los Angeles. Today it can be done for less than $300. As prices fell, more people flew. In 2000, more than half of Americans took at least one round-trip flight. You might have to spread eagle while a guard slides a wand up your crotch. You may have an elbow in your ribs and a seat back in your chin, but long-distance lovers get to see each other, and if your mother gets sick, you can be there the next day. Affordable transportation does more than reunite people. It also allows them to sample the phantasmagoria of planet Earth. This is the pastime that we exalt as travel when we do it, and revile as tourism when someone else does it. But it surely has to count as one of the things that make life worth living. To see the Grand Canyon, New York, the Aurora Borealis, Jerusalem, these are not just sensuous pleasures, but experiences that widen the scope of our consciousness, allowing us to take in the vastness of space, time, nature, and human initiative. Though we bristle at the motor coaches and tour guides, the selfie-shooting throngs in their tacky shorts, we must concede that life is better when people can expand their awareness of our planet and species, rather than being imprisoned within walking distance of their place of birth. With the rise of disposable income and the declining cost of plane travel, more people have been exploring the world, as we see in Figure 17-8. And no, the travelers aren't just lining up for wax museums and rides at Disney World. The number of areas in the world that are protected from development and economic exploitation exceeds 160,000, and increases daily. As we saw in Figure 10-6, far more of the natural world is being set aside in nature preserves. Another way in which the scope of our aesthetic experience has been magnified is food. The late 19th century American diet consisted mainly of pork and starch. Before refrigeration and motorized transport, most fruits and vegetables would have spoiled before they reached a consumer, so farmers grew non-perishables like turnips, beans, and potatoes. Apples were the only fruit, most of which went into cider. As recently as the 1970s, Florida souvenir shops sold bags of oranges for tourists to take home as gifts. The American diet was called white bread and meat and potatoes for good reason. Adventurous cooks might whip up some Spam fritters, mock apple pie made from Ritz crackers, or perfection salad, coleslaw in lemon jello. New cuisines introduced by immigrants were so exotic that they became the butt of jokes, including Italian, "Mamma mia, that's a spicy meatball!" Mexican, "Solves the gas shortage!" Chinese, "An hour later and you're hungry again!" And Japanese, "Bait, not food." Today, even small towns and shopping mall food courts offer a cosmopolitan menu, sometimes with all these cuisines, plus Greek, Thai, Indian, Vietnamese, and Middle Eastern. Grocers have broadened their offerings as well, from a few hundred items in the 1920s to 2,200 in the 1950s, 17,500 in the 1980s, and 39,500 in 2015. Last but not least, access to the finest products of the human mind has been fabulously broadened and democratized. It's hard for us to reconstruct the gnawing boredom of the isolated rural households of yesteryear. In the late 19th century, there was not only no internet, but no radio, television, movies, or musical recordings, and for the majority of households, not even a book or newspaper. For entertainment, men would go to the saloon to drink. The writer and editor William Dean Howells, 1837 to 1920, entertained himself as a boy by rereading the pages of an old newspaper, which his father had used to wallpaper their Ohio cabin. A country dweller today can choose from among hundreds of television channels and half a billion websites, embracing every newspaper and magazine in the world, including their archives going back more than a century. Every great work of literature that is out of copyright, an encyclopedia more than 70 times the size of Britannica with about the same level of accuracy, and every classic work of art and music. He could fact-check rumors on Snopes, teach himself math and science at Khan Academy, build his word power with the American Heritage Dictionary, enlighten himself with the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, and watch lectures by the world's great scholars, writers, and critics, many long dead. Today, an impoverished Hillel would not have to pass out from cold while eavesdropping on lessons through the skylight of a schoolhouse. Even for wealthy Western urbanites who always had the run of the palaces of culture, access to arts and letters has expanded tremendously. When I was a student, a movie buff had to wait years for a classic film to be shown at a local repertory theater or on late-night television, if it was shown at all. Today, it can be streamed on demand. I can listen to any of thousands of songs while jogging, washing the dishes, or waiting in line at the registry of motor vehicles. With a few keystrokes, I could lose myself in the complete works of Caravaggio, the original trailer for Rashomon, Dylan Thomas reciting, "And Death Shall Have No Dominion," Eleanor Roosevelt reading aloud the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Maria Callas singing "O Mio Babbino Caro," Billie Holiday singing "My Man Don't Love Me," and Solomon Linda singing "Mbube," experiences I could not have had for love or money just a few years ago. Cheap hi-fi headphones and soon cardboard virtual reality glasses enhance the aesthetic experience well beyond the tinny speakers and muddy black-and-white reproductions of my youth. And those who like paper can buy a used copy of Doris Lessing's The Golden Notebook, Vladimir Nabokov's Pale Fire, or Wole Soyinka's Ake, The Years of Childhood, for a dollar apiece. A combination of internet technology and crowdsourcing from thousands of volunteers has led to flabbergasting access to the great works of humankind. There can be no question of which was the greatest era for culture. The answer has to be today, until it is superseded by tomorrow. The answer does not depend on invidious comparisons of the quality of the works of today and those of the past, which we are in no position to make, just as many of the great works of the past were not appreciated in their time. It follows from our ceaseless creativity and our fantastically cumulative cultural memory. We have, at our fingertips, virtually all the works of genius prior to our time, together with those of our own time, whereas the people who lived before our time had neither. Better still, the world's cultural patrimony is now available not just to the rich and well-located, but to anyone who is connected to the vast web of knowledge, which means most of humanity, and soon all of it. Chapter 18. Happiness. But are we any happier? If we have a shred of cosmic gratitude, we ought to be. An American in 2015, compared with his or her counterpart a half century earlier, will live 9 years longer, have had 3 more years of education, earn an additional $33,000 a year per family member, only a third of which, rather than half, will go to necessities, and have an additional 8 hours a week of leisure. He or she can spend that leisure time reading on the web, listening to music on a smartphone, streaming movies on high-definition TV, Skyping with friends and relatives, or dining on Thai food instead of spam fritters. But if popular impressions are a guide, today's Americans are not 1.5 times happier, as they would be if happiness tracked income, or a third happier if it tracked education, or even an eighth happier if it tracked longevity. People seem to bitch, moan, whine, carp, and kvetch as much as ever, and the proportion of Americans who tell pollsters that they are happy has remained steady for decades. Popular culture has noticed the ingratitude in the internet meme and Twitter hashtag First World Problems, and in a monologue by the comedian Louis C.K. known as Everything's Amazing and Nobody's Happy. When I read things like The Foundations of Capitalism Are Shattering, I'm like, maybe we need some time where we're walking around with a donkey, with pots clanging on the sides. 'Cause now we live in an amazing world, and it's wasted on the crappiest generation of spoiled idiots. Flying is the worst one, because people come back from flights and they tell you their story. They're like, it was the worst day of my life. We get on the plane, and they made us sit there on the runway for 40 minutes. Oh, really? Then what happened next? Did you fly through the air incredibly like a bird? Did you soar into the clouds impossibly? Did you partake in the miracle of human flight and then land softly on giant tires that you couldn't even conceive how they fucking put air in them? You're sitting in a chair in the sky. You're like a Greek myth right now. People say there's delays, air travel's too slow, New York to California in 5 hours. That used to take 30 years. And a bunch of you would die on the way there, and you'd get shot in the neck with an arrow, and the other passengers would just bury you and put a stick there with your hat on it and keep walking. The Wright brothers would kick us all in the crotch if they knew. Writing in 1999, John Mueller summed up the common understanding of modernity at the time. People seem simply to have taken the remarkable economic improvement in stride and have deftly found new concerns to get upset about. In an important sense, then, things never get better. The understanding was based on more than just impressions of American malaise. In 1973, the economist Richard Easterlin identified a paradox that has since been named for him. Though in comparisons within a country, richer people are happier, in comparisons across countries, the richer ones appeared to be no happier than poorer ones. And in comparisons over time, people did not appear to get happier as their countries got richer. The Easterlin paradox was explained with two theories from psychology. According to the theory of the hedonic treadmill, people adapt to changes in their fortunes like eyes adapting to light or darkness and quickly return to a genetically determined baseline. According to the theory of social comparison, or reference groups, status anxiety, or relative deprivation, which we examined in Chapter 9, people's happiness is determined by how well they think they are doing relative to their compatriots. So as the country as a whole gets richer, no one feels happier. Indeed, if their country becomes more unequal, then even if they get richer, they may feel worse. If in this sense things never get better, one can wonder whether all that economic, medical, and technological so-called progress was worth it. Many argue that it was not. We have been spiritually impoverished, they say, by the rise of individualism, materialism, consumerism, and decadent wealth, and by the erosion of traditional communities with their hearty social bonds and their sense of meaning and purpose bestowed by religion. That is why, one often reads, depression, anxiety, loneliness and suicide have been soaring, and why Sweden, that secular paradise, has a famously high rate of suicide. In 2016, the activist George Monbiot prosecuted the cultural pessimist's time-honored campaign against modernity in an op-ed entitled, "Neoliberalism is Creating Loneliness. That's What's Wrenching Society Apart." The tagline was, "Epidemics of mental illness are crushing the minds and bodies of millions. It's time to ask where we are heading and why." The article itself warned, "The latest catastrophic figures for children's mental health in England reflect the global crisis." If all those extra years of life and health, all that additional knowledge and leisure and breadth of experience, all those advances in peace and safety and democracy and rights, have really left us no happier, but just lonelier and more suicidal, it would be history's greatest joke on humanity. But before we start walking around with a donkey with pots clanging on the sides, we had better take a closer look at the facts about human happiness. At least since the Axial Age, thinkers have deliberated about what makes for a good life, and today happiness has become a major topic in social science. Some intellectuals are incredulous, even offended, that happiness has become a subject for economists rather than just poets, essayists, and philosophers. But the approaches are not opposed. Social scientists often begin their studies of happiness with ideas that were first conceived by artists and philosophers, and they can pose questions about historical and global patterns that cannot be answered by solitary reflection, no matter how insightful. That is especially true for the question of whether progress has left people happier. To answer it, we must first assuage the critics' incredulity over the possibility that happiness can even be measured. Artists, philosophers, and social scientists agree that well-being is not a single dimension. People can be better off in some ways and worse off in others. Let's distinguish the major ones. We can begin with objective aspects of well-being, the gifts we deem intrinsically worthwhile, whether or not their possessors appreciate them. At the top of that list is life itself. Also on it are health,
education, freedom, and leisure. That is the mindset behind Louis C.K.'s social criticism, and in part, behind Amartya Sen's and Martha Nussbaum's conceptions of fundamental human capabilities. In this sense, we can say that people who live long, healthy, and stimulating lives are truly better off.